Blog Talk Radio.
The Amy Beth Arkowitz Show here on BTR. We weave together a mosaic of voices from the arts, pop culture, politics, and personal growth. If you're listening to us live on Friday, and boy, what a week it's been weather-wise, huh, folks? In the Northeast, we got hit with, I think, what the Midwest had earlier in the week, so please take it easy. But if you're listening live and you want to join the conversation, 347-857-4505. We'll get you into the mix of cultural commentary and creative inspiration. We'll take your calls later. First, I want to welcome our special guest, Jane Devon, to the show. She's the author of the poignant and powerful memoir, Elephant Girl. She also spent some time traveling around America and blogging about it, and you can read her opinions on various social and political issues on her website, janedevon.com, and also the Huffington Post. So enough information and material to warrant at least a half a dozen episodes, but we're delighted to welcome you for the first time, Jane. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Amy Beth. How are you?
I'm happy to have you here. I'm great, thank you, and glad to finally talk to you. I know we communicate via Twitter and the wonderful world of social media, but here you are, live and in person, as they say.
Looking forward to it.
Let's talk about your powerful, poignant memoir, Elephant Girl, which, you know, I always tell people it takes such courage to cultivate your authentic voice, to write down your truth, your story, ramp up that courage tenfold, to share a story, especially a painful one, with the world. Tell us about your process when you decided to write the book and to ultimately share it with everybody.
Well, I'll tell you, honestly, that book took me about 36 years to write. I started writing when I was very young, when I was 10 years old, but it was always a very secret activity. And I think this is where a lot of would-be writers run into a brick wall, is that...
Uh-oh, we lost Jane. Okay, hopefully she'll be calling back. All right, Jane, give us a call back when you can. 347-857-4505 is the number to call to get you into the mix here on Blog Talk Radio. Technical difficulty, as I say, please stand by. We will hopefully get Jane and her wisdom back with us, and you too can get involved in the commentary. So let's see what we can do here.
The number you have dialed has not been recognized. Please try again.
From you at 347-857-4505. Hopefully Jane will give us a call back. We're having a little trouble getting her line. Technical difficulties do sometimes occur. But really, her memoir is a very personal one. Talks about her struggles growing up and dealing with a very abusive childhood. It's an interesting story, and if you want to find out more about it, you can certainly go to her website, janedevon.com. And She independently published it as well, and I wanted to talk to her a little bit about that. But memoirs are a fascinating genre because, and they came under fire, I know, a couple of years ago in the wake of the James Frey Oprah brouhaha. And remember when he wrote that book, and I forget what it's called, Million Little Pieces, I think it was, right? Or A Billion Little Pieces, really about his struggle with drug addiction, and Oprah ballyhooed it and heralded it as this great groundbreaking true story, and it turned out he pretty much made up the whole thing out of whole cloth, and his agent came under scrutiny. It became a whole big deal. And memoirs, all these fake memoirs, started falling off the shelves, and it also became a big deal about that. And I remember at the time kind of laughing and thinking, gee, as a writer, as a fiction writer, I know it's hard to get your work published. So if fiction fell out of favor and memoirs were in, writers do what they have to do to get published. But truthfully, of course, there were memoir writers who were upset because they said this taints the whole genre, and true stories are now being rushed with a very negative patina and all of that, and I understand, but it was interesting. It's an interesting genre. It's been in and out of favor. It was the it genre for a while. I think it's fascinating because it's fascinating to hear other people's stories, to see what people go through. And really, as a writer and a writing teacher and creativity coach, it's fascinating to me to see what people do in terms of you know, what they want to keep in and what they keep out is also equally as important. So I think we're trying to get a hold of Jane. I think she's trying to communicate with us. Okay, we're going to try to do it, Jane. I see information here about her telephone number. So we're going to take a break. We're going to try to take care of that if we can. We've been trying to call her, but we're going to try to do that as well. Technical difficulties, as they say, please stand by, kids, and we will endeavor to do that. So here. Hang in. Hang in, Jane. We're going to try to get you. We're trying to get you. Hang on. Here on Block Talk Radio, you can get into the mix, too, at 347-857-4545.
Hello.
All right, Jane, I think we're back. Are we back?
Yes, we are. I'm so sorry about that.
That's okay.
God, I've had this, it was fully charged up, and my battery just died.
It just died. It's funny. It happens. We were trying to get you, and then I was getting a thing that said the number isn't recognized, and then you messaged me and said, try it again. Anyway, we're back. I was just giving my little spiel about memoirs and how fascinating the format is.
I was telling you that book took me 36 years to write because, like a lot of would-be writers, I was afraid of people reading my work.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, not only that, but, you know, I came from a very shame-based family, a very violent family, emotionally violent as well, and I didn't want to rock the boat.
Mm-hmm.
And so talking about highly personal things and things that hurt you, I was afraid of being outcast or mocked or, you know, one of the things that you still run into especially a woman, talks about pain in her life, or even the very sensitive subject of rape, you get a lot of accusations of, oh, she's just a victim. You know, she just wants to be a victim. And those things are so hurtful because these are real life and honest experiences, and you're not really free to talk about them in a way that's always healing.
Absolutely.
When people read them.
What was it that got you the courage then to go ahead and do it?
I finally stopped caring what other people thought. And it took me 46 years to get to that point where I was just so fed up with living this life. In fact, I wrote something today because, as you know, it's International Women's Day. And so, you know, I was thinking about that because we often think about those kinds of days in a historical context. But, you know, feminism is very much a part of our everyday lives now. But for women of my generation, we were brought up to really, at least I was, my self-worth was all tied up with what other people thought of me. And if other people thought well of me, then I felt worthy. If other people said positive things about me, then that was my worth. If I could help somebody, then I was worthy. If I didn't have anything of value to offer them, then I wasn't. So, you know, that really doesn't bode well in telling your own truths and your own stories.
Right. That's right. That's very true. So you finally got liberated. You got either self-growth through your own process or therapy or a combination and decided I'm going to just take control of my own story and tell it. And this is a big story to tell. I'm sure it didn't go over all that well with your family in revealing all these things about your family.
Well, that was the other issue. My mom died in 1999, and I hadn't spoken with my stepfather, who I call the chief. I hadn't spoken with him in 20 years. And my sisters, you know, we grew more and more distant through the years, so I didn't have the family onus at 46 that I had, you know, at 36.
Right.
And, you know, and then I would, of course, I worried, well, what would my children think, right? Because part of my book is about them. But my daughter was extremely supportive of the process, and that helped. That helped a lot. So, you know, as I grew older and moved away from you know, my family, and as I, you know, just kind of got beat up through the years, yeah. I kind of realized that, you know, you can be sometimes the best person you can be, and it will never be good enough for some people.
Right. You have to be true to yourself. That's the key. And the
right.
writing process is so freeing for so many people because it lets you liberate, get it out, just get the story out. So tell
right.
us about
and I think if you spend your time chasing acceptance, you're going to live a very unhappy life because you will never, you know, find the type of acceptance that you want out in the world until you finally accept yourself.
Right. That's very profound. Very simple, but very profound. You're right. I mean, who are you living for? What is your life about, exactly? So tell us your story a little bit. I mean, obviously, you can't. And I know you write the story in a three distinct voices over your period of life, your life, correct?
Right. Well, the first part deals with the child part, and I was the result of an affair that my mother had. But I of course, wasn't told that. In fact, it was vehemently denied even when I started asking questions very early in life. Because my two older sisters, one has red hair and green eyes, the other has blonde hair and green eyes. And here I was, this olive-skinned, brown-eyed, you know, dark-haired child. And so it wasn't just me. I mean, we would go to the grocery store and other people would say, is she adopted? You know? So the suspicion started early in life and was vehemently denied. I always asked if I was adopted or where I came from. But it wasn't just the looks, it was the treatment. My mother detested me. She really made no bones that I was not her favorite child. And then I had this stepfather who was just very, very, I mean, he was not a great father to any of us. He was kind of a cold man, but he was abusive to me and not to my older sisters. And
so
he would call me things like...
Was he your older sister's natural father?
Yeah. He was the man that my mother was married to for all those years. She never did get a divorce. So I would get called names like nigger and monkey lips and, you know, all sorts of pejorative names and had really no clue. So, you know, when you grow up that way, I just thought that there was something very wrong with me, that I was very flawed. And so I virtually had no self-esteem as a child. And I didn't know why. I didn't know what was wrong with me. It was like, you know, it was like having a big bump in the middle of your forehead, but only everybody else could see it, but I couldn't.
Right. And, of course, kids internalize all of that. I mean, you take it
on yourself. Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Rushing. And I didn't know what to do with all this love that I did have because I loved my mother, you know, as most children do. But it was like, I just tried so desperately all the time to win her love. It was like my childhood goal and ambition was to get her to smile or to get her to say a kind word or, you know, or anything, you know. It was like my singular, excuse me?
No, that's fine. I was going to say, the harder you tried, the harder, you know, she made it probably for you, you know.
Well, it was just
it, the harder you tried. Yeah,
It really did end up that way. It's like the meaner she would be, the more I would like I have to be good. But I was never good enough, you know, which of course led to that whole adulthood of trying to gain acceptance out in the world. So anyway, because of that type of childhood, I was very fearful all the time, very afraid that of getting in trouble. And when I was 9 years old, my mother sent me off for the summer to people that I didn't know. She apparently knew them from several years back. And anyway, they showed up at our house one day and just wanted to take me to California. And my mom said, yes, take her. And I spent the summer getting molested and raped and having pornographic movies made of me and tried desperately to escape. And I was 9. And it was terrifying. It was absolutely terrifying.
Now, did your mother know anything? When did your family find out about it, that this happened? Or?
I did not tell her until I was almost 21 years old.
You kept it a secret that you...
Yeah, because I couldn't go...
The shame of it, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, when I left there, he called my mother and said he was sending me back because I was bad.
Oh.
And when I got off the bus in Reno, my mother was furious with me for misbehaving. So I got punished for misbehaving after this summer of you know, terror. And so, of course, I didn't tell because that would have just made it worse. And,
The compounding of the shame. Yeah. I was going to say, it's the compounding of the shame. It's like this horrible thing happened to you. You internalize it. You feel like it's your fault. Then you get punished for some, you know, sort of nebulous, phony, baloney, you know, I was bad when you were being... violated in such a horrible way. It's awful.
And then anything that I had ever internalized before was like 100 times stronger. My sense of being on the outside, my sense of, you know, of being punished in some way. It just, my sense of being an unworthy person just blew up. And at that point, I really just started to self-immolate. And, you know, on the inside and on the outside, I was trying so desperately to keep up, you know, being who I was. But everything started falling apart. School, relationships, just, you know, everything in my life started falling apart. But I couldn't show it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. The looking good veneer of everything's okay. Yeah. Were there people at all in your life when you were a kid, teachers, anybody who you could have reached out to find a support system, or were you just so ashamed that there was no way of?
I wish there had been. For me, there wasn't, and I searched for for things like that, especially I ended up leaving home at 16. And one of the things that I really wanted and needed was some sort of mentor or guide. And so I really searched out other adults that I thought might take that role. I was very naive because I thought I could go to college and I, you know, that somebody would help me with the paperwork. And, you know, I watched too many, you know, ABC after school specials. I always thought that there was going to be someone somewhere in the works that was going to help me figure out my new adult life. And there wasn't.
It's so poignant when you say that, because for so many of us who, by the grace of God, did not experience the horrors that you experienced, you take so much for granted that there is always somebody, whether it's a family person or a teacher or whoever, who is going to help you and guide you. And in those initial things that everybody just says, oh, this is what you do, this is how you apply to college, you take it for granted. But for so many people who don't have that, it really is a serious bump in the road, and just like practical things in life, let alone the emotional support and foundation that you desperately need.
I seriously thought that I would show up at that college office and, you know, some nice counselor would say, oh, here, you know, let me help you figure out the world. And of course, no, there wasn't. And so I was just so lost. You know, I didn't know anything. Here I was, 16 years old, living in my own apartment, paying rent, working at a factory, had no clue, you know, about a checking account or you know, how to budget or, you know, how to get into college, nothing. But I really tried. And
so you had like an adult life, though, in a way. So even though you didn't know all the things to do, you had much more of an adult life than most 16-year-olds have.
Yes, but I figured out that, you know, the college system wouldn't let me go without my parents signing off.
Oh, wow.
Even though we were estranged. And you had to be, I think at the time, it was either 26 and single or over 18 and married.
Really? Wow.
In order to be independent from your parents. So I didn't get to go.
Wow, that's interesting. I didn't realize that. I think 18, because 18 is, you would think, you know.
No, you have to be married, or at the time you did.
Yeah, wow. So that was in one hurdle. So you didn't go to college at that time because you couldn't do it.
No, and, you know, and I was raped again at 13. Mm. And so that threw me into a whole other tailspin where I turned very promiscuous. In the hopes of numbing my pain. I just figured, well, if these things are going to happen to me, I'm going to make them happen until it doesn't hurt anymore.
Now, was there any thought of counseling or therapy at this point, or you just were still so hiding and suppressing it?
No, the only counseling or therapy I had, and I don't know if you read that part of my book, but I took a joint to school at 13 in order to make friends. It was from my sister's boyfriend. I had never smoked pot before. I hadn't even smoked it that day when I took it to school. And I invited a whole bunch of people out to lunch. And, of course, you know, it being junior high school, about 50 kids showed up. And I ended up getting busted. And to make an example of me, the court sent me to a juvenile hall and then to a drug rehab.
For one joint, yeah, okay, that makes sense.
For one joint. And at the time that I entered the drug rehab, I had never smoked pot. I had never done a drug.
You were just carrying around a joint. That's what happened. That was your big crime.
Yeah. Well, lucky me, it ended up being a Synanon program, and I don't know if you're familiar with that program, but it's a really brutal program where they tear kids down. And the impetus is that they're supposed to build them back up, but there wasn't a lot of building back up. All they did was tear them down. So that was the form of counseling I received, was to be told I was
that's
a
just what you
puny little
point, right?
snot and a bitch and a slut and, you know. And so I was terrified of, like, counseling and therapists and, and everything after that. So no, I didn't seek it. And I just kept reading. You know, I was always an avid reader, and books had always been my crutch
salvation.
And my salvation. So I started picking up all these self-help books, you know, every single one I could find on how to be a better person and how to navigate the world. And, you know, just it ended up in a way messing myself up more in some ways, and in other ways trying on all these different personas that these books, you know, said would guarantee success. You know, like how to make people like you, you know, have a firm handshake, smile, you know, compliment them. So I was always doing these, trying on these different personas from these self-help books, which is kind of amusing to look at now. But I was very into that for several years. I was studying Buddhism and Dale Carnegie, you know, just a mishmash of anything that I thought, you know, might help me find my way.
Because you didn't have any role models, really. So these were your role models. This is all you could find. So you were saying, okay, what do I do? Give me a guidebook. You know?
Right. And it was an attempt to heal, you know, but a very awkward attempt. And in my mind, I kept thinking, well, I can shove down anything that ever happened to me, but I need to make now a starting point. I need to start a new life. So I was constantly trying to reinvent a new person rather than dealing with the one that was really in pain and a wreck.
If I mask it, if I just start over, I pretend this never happened.
Exactly. Yeah, and I would do that over and over and over again, because when the new persona didn't work, and when that got hurt, then I would jump to a new one.
Another one. Yeah, without dealing with what was really underlying. Sure. So when did it dawn on you, I got to deal with what's underlying, and I've got to really just own it, own all the sorrow and the pain?
You know, it didn't really start until after I had my first child, when I had my daughter. It was really the first time I understood how much love I could feel for somebody. And in doing that, you also have to realize that you weren't loved the same way, that nobody felt the same way about you. And that kind of pain mixed with that kind of joy, right, makes you reexamine your whole life. Like, you know, of course, you ask the hard question, like, how could my mother not feel this way about me?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But on the other hand, you're like, here's this precious human being, and I'm going to make sure she doesn't go through anything like I went through. And so it was really the first time I started even slightly analyzing my life.
And so the healing began, and then writing it down, I think, was probably extremely difficult, but at the same time a healing process as well, I'm assuming, yes?
Well, you know, you write for catharsis I wrote for catharsis for years.
Yep.
And then it reached a point where it really wasn't cathartic anymore. It was more like, this is a story that, well, let me put it this way. When I was young, I used to go to the library searching for books that reflected my life, and I didn't find any. I found things that were relatively close. Well, to give you an example, you know, when I was, after I was raped at 9, I went to the library and I was like searching everywhere for like information on rape, right? And the closest I could find were like Harold Robbins novels and Erica Jong and Lisa Alter and Harlequin books. And in all of these books, no one bled. I bled profusely.
Oh, wow.
And so I was like wondering, well, and I also had a prolapsed rectum when I came home because I was anally raped.
Oh, gosh.
And I kept trying to fix it myself. I was 9.
Oh, God.
I was 9 and, like, you know, trying to fix my own prolapsed rectum.
And you had nobody and your mom. You couldn't tell your mom, obviously. And this is how you
no,
were
of course
so
not.
Shamed. And it's unimaginable, the pain that you went through, and yet you managed to triumph out of it. It took you decades, as you always say, but you did do it.
Yeah. But, you know, I started writing for catharsis. But
right.
When I really began to write my story was when the catharsis was over, when it was already healed, when that wound was already mostly healed is when I started writing. And the reason I wrote was because I knew that there were other women like me.
Yes.
That I was not the only one. And I think it was Toni Morrison who said that if you want to read a book and it hasn't been written yet,
write it. Yep.
Then you must write it. And that's the way I felt. Like, you know, maybe there's only a dozen women like me. But, man, they deserve to, you know, if they're going in search of a story like theirs, there should be something out there for them. And I didn't see that there were. There's a lot of memoirs of childhood abuse. But they either all end on a happy note, you know, or they all just end, like when the subject turns 18 or the rich aunt comes out of the woodwork to pay for college or, you know,
yeah.
or you know, Dave Pelzer gets rescued by foster care or Jeanette Walls ends up, you know, going to college and finding a rich boyfriend. You know, I mean, there was really no stories out there that said, well, what happens when you don't have a rich aunt or you get to go to college or you're rescued by foster care? What happens when you're really just left to your own devices and you've got all this baggage? And that's what I wanted to write about. And I thought, well, even if there's just a handful of women like me, this story's for them.
Well, sadly, as you know, and I know you've heard from all kinds of people, I'm sure, since you've written the book and it's been out there for a while now, there are a lot more than a handful of people who have gone through not the exact same thing, because obviously this is your personal story, but a lot of harrowing experiences. So I'm sure you've helped a lot of people, and that must be gratifying, too, to hear from people who say, hey, this book really helped me.
That is the best thing in the world, and it makes up for every person who doesn't get it, is I get at least a dozen letters a week from women who say this or that part of the story I relate to and thank you for writing it. And, you know, and it's not an egotistical type of stroke at all. It's more like a sense of camaraderie.
Right.
You know?
Definitely, yeah. You can aspire together, so to speak, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Now, you mentioned, have you fielded criticism for tackling this topic? You said some people who don't get it. I mean, are people skeptical? Is that what you're hearing on the other side of it?
Well, you know, like I referred to earlier, there's always those people that when, and God knows why they would even pick up a book like mine, but they do, you know, or they're used to reading novels about it, which is funny because on the first page of my book, it says this is a memoir, all these things truly happened, and some people read and say it's an unbelievable novel.
Mm.
Or you know, the most hurtful criticism is, of course, you know, well, you know, what a perpetual victim. This, you know, she acts like the victim, and it's like, but I was.
You were a victim, that's right.
And it took a long, long time to get over that. But, you know, I was. And I don't know, you know, you want some sort of hero to pop out of this mess, right? And that's what they're waiting for, is for someone to say, oh, gosh, I've turned 18 now. I'm all cured.
Yeah, unfortunately.
You know.
Unfortunately.
Yeah, like you're just going to jump out of your 18th birthday cake and just, you know, be a whole, well, self-sufficient, you know, amazingly perceptive person, you know, and that you're not going to make any mistakes and, you know, all your damages will just heal with one therapy session or, you know.
And it doesn't even work for people who have a, you know, a well-adjusted life at 18. You're not ready to tackle the world. So if you're going through the amount of trauma, really, that you went through, you can't expect that to happen overnight, of course.
Well,
not.
And it's not, you know, if trauma is never a one-shot deal.
Exactly.
If you go through sustained trauma for years on end as a child, you do not, even with therapy, you don't come out on the other side this whole well, happy, adjusted person.
Right. Unfortunately, that's right.
Your whole life anyway, even as you say, as a well-adjusted person, is a period of learning, relearning, and unlearning.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying. Everybody has something.
Yes. Yes. But for an abused person, that unlearning is the hardest task of all. We learn new stuff all the time. But, you know, we're piling them on top of old ideas and on top of old wounds and, you know, old perceptions. And in my case, I didn't find out until I was in my 40s that I had suffered brain damage as a child. There was scar tissue, you know, and I had all these small problems with the way other people perceived my language and, you know, the way I spoke. And it was always like this little conundrum, like, well, how come I can say, you know, it's a blustery day and 14 people will take offense to it and somebody else can say it and it just passes by? You know, but I really had tonal problems, and I didn't understand it. I didn't know that I did. But, you know, it was diagnosed later as being on the autism spectrum. You know, they diagnosed it as Asperger's, but it was mine was due to specific brain damage as a child.
Now,
that
brain
I had
damage
no clue
caused
about.
By your, was that from your abuse?
They really can't pinpoint it. I mean, you know, it could have been from being shaken. It could have been from being hit in the head. It could have been from a fall I took as a child. I mean, we don't know. But I didn't find that out until I was 40 and getting an MRI for you know, something else altogether.
You've been through the gamut, Jane, and here you are, though, and this is what's so amazing about you and your story and the fact that you're out here talking about it, is that you have come out the other side, obviously not unscathed, because nobody's completely unscathed. That's the unfortunate nature of life. You know, you take your bumps and bruises and you have to roll with them, but you've had more than your fair share. It's just remarkable, so I give you so much credit for that. What do you think about the genre of memoir? And I know it's taken some hits over the last few years in the wake of that whole, you know, James Frey, Oprah brouhaha. Was that something which you were worried about people saying whether you're telling the truth or not, whether it's a real story?
I wasn't particularly worried about it. My concern in getting this book out there was that agents wouldn't touch it because I'm not a famous person. You know, I don't have 30,000 Twitter followers. So when I started making the rounds of agents, it was like, well, who are you to write a memoir? You know, and then it was like, oh my God, another child abuse story. But it's like, you know, I wanted to say, but wait, this isn't just, okay, yes, it's got child abuse in it, but it's really the smallest part of the book. It's only the first few chapters. You know, this book is dealing with all the after effects, you know. And, you know, you make a lot of bad choices and you make, you know, you really just don't understand life when you come from that kind of life, right? You don't understand normalcy or what's normal or, you know, what's acceptable. And that's really what the bulk of my book is about. So that was really my concern with writing a memoir. I was told by one really exclusive agent that memoirs were just out. But I don't believe that's the case. I don't think it'll ever be the case. I think that human stories are, there's no matter if two people have similar stories, they're still different for the way that they were lived and perceived. And I don't think that will ever go out of fashion.
Well, I don't think it will ever go out of fashion either. There was a time when it was the it genre for a while, and then there were all these stories after James Frey, all these fake memoirs came out where a lot of people, and as I was mentioning while we were having our technical difficulties, my reaction was somewhat different to a lot of people who were outraged to find out that maybe he made up his story and maybe other people faked these memoirs. Not that, I mean, it may taint it for other memoir writers, I suppose, but as a writer, a fiction writer in particular, it's hard to get a novel published, so fiction is really tough. So I'm like, like if they had what they had to do, you do what you have to do as a writer to get your work out there. So, but yes, obviously, I'm kind of being glib about it because you don't want to take away from a true story. A true story should be true, but a memoir is your memory of the story. It's your story through your prism. So somebody else who lived through those events with you would have a different version of it. So
right,
so
you know, and this was the argument that I had with my sister. You know, that if she wanted to write a memoir, hers
right.
would be very different from mine because she had a different life than I did.
Exactly. Right.
You know, and so you know, my memories, my life, but you know, there's. Every part of my book is provable in some fashion. I have names or some witnesses or some backup. So I wasn't really worried that people would say it wasn't true. I was more worried about the kind of criticism that, like I said, is still personally hurtful, but which I've also learned to ignore, which is, you know, part of growth is that, like I said, you just can't please everybody. You're never going to have any sort of readability, and if anybody ever feels bad about their own writing, they need to go look up some of their favorite authors on Amazon and see what, you know, what kind of bad reviews have been left for them. Because,
sure.
You know, I mean, you can read Maya Angelou, and she's got 1-star reviews that are just wretched.
Well, because
so,
the internet,
you know,
in particular, everybody's a critic and there people come out of the woodwork for whatever their particular agenda may be to malign people for whatever reason that makes them feel better.
Oh, absolutely.
It's crazy. And it's mind-blowing if you let it. You know?
And there are actual groups that are kind of like on Amazon, they have these forums where there's mm-hmm. just a small little contingent of people that live to do just that. They will target someone and, you know, target their book and do that. But, you know,
I don't
what's
get
the
it.
Saying?
I mean,
they never
of,
built
a
monument to critics.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Right?
But what a waste of time and what a waste of energy to want to tear down people. I mean, if you have a legitimate criticism, that's fine. But to make this your raison d'etre
well,
to go after authors, it makes
look
sense.
Look at YouTube, the YouTube comments. I mean, you can have the funniest, cutest little baby video on there of a baby laughing and, you know, 100 people will downvote it or call the child names. It's just, you know, it's the culture we live in you know, people can be anonymous and they can also express some really nasty thoughts and ideas anonymously. And, you know, it took me a long time, but, you know, I did learn to just go, well, you know, look at the positive, but, you know, I was always one of those people that I would process the one negative thing and ignore the 200 positives.
I know. Unfortunately, that's human nature in some ways that, you know, you look at you have a lot of people saying great things and then you focus on the negative. It's, you know, flip it. You have to work on flipping it, and you really do have to work on that, and that takes a lot of
conscious effort.
It really does. And a lot of cognitive behavioral concepts of just, you know, you think it'll be it kind of thing, you know, and you have to really recondition yourself all those years.
Right. And it's so great when, you know, when you do receive criticism that is actually valid, you know, it makes you appreciate it that much more.
Right.
You know, so, and that too is a positive. I don't mind if somebody, you know, writes and says, well, you know, I think this part of your book, your plot was off, or I didn't understand this. That's great, you know, but when they start personally attacking, you know, it's not so great. But, you know.
And it's more about them than it is about you at that point, I think, because it's not a constructive literary criticism. It's a personal attack based on whatever their agenda may be. And I don't know. I've long since, I've worked on a lot of websites, and the comments that some people leave are just astounding, and it used to annoy me.
well,
but now I just don't.
As you know, I've written for the Huffington Post, so I've gotten
a
lot of that.
Yeah, I'm sure you do.
Yeah.
And you just have to laugh it off or turn it off at some point because it's
Well, you have to, because
where they want you to interact with the readers and respond. And it's like, all right, I'll do a little bit of that. But after a while, I mean, if it's substantive, okay. But if it just, you know, pops
right.
out for no reason,
right.
it's like there's
right.
no
when they start getting into the pinko, liberal, commie,
yeah.
you know.
And even more colorful terms that we don't want to get into. But, yes, I've been there. I'm with you on that. What are your influences? Do you have writers that particularly influenced you?
When I was a child, it was Pearl Buck and Maxine Hong Kingston and Toni Morrison. The Woman Warrior was one of my all-time favorite books. That was by Kingston.
I
just loved her imagery. And I loved the Asian literature of Pearl Buck because it transported me into a different world in a different time.
Yeah. That's such a value in writing, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, and Toni Morrison wrote pain in a way that even though those lives that she wrote about were, you know, so far removed from mine, that I could relate to so much of what her characters went through. And The Bluest Eye was one of the first books that I read, and I cried, right? I cried. That really just like, because I could so relate to the feelings in it.
Books are such a great thing for young people, for everybody, to really reach out and connect to other people, other experiences. They don't have to be anywhere near your experience, as you said, but just to know there's somebody else out there connecting with emotions. You don't know what's going to strike a chord with you and lift you into another place, another dimension. And it's just so that was, at least you had that as a salvation to help you along.
Absolutely. And then, you know, in my early adult years, it was Dorothy Allison. And, you know, The Bastard Out of Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
And that was like my eye-opening book. And, you know, I didn't, part of my book, too, also deals with, you know, pretty much knowing from a child that I was gay, but really not having any, talk about having no role models and no experiences and nowhere to go. And also questioning myself as to whether I felt that way because I was raped or was I really that way? And so, you know, so Dorothy Allison was like kind of helped me with that. You know, Ruby Fruit Jungle. I read all of those books. You know, I think reading is very timely that way. You go through certain periods in your life where you need certain things, and whether the books are fiction or nonfiction, if there's stories that speak to the truth that you're living at that time, they're invaluable.
So what are you doing now? What are you working on now? Do you have a new work? I know
I'm working on a novel, which is totally different from my memoir, and it's called Hunger Like Love. And, you know, like I said, it's totally different, but it also deals with some themes that I'm familiar with. And that is a woman who kind of sacrifices her entire self to motherhood and being a single mother and kind of loses herself in the process. And then as her son leaves home and becomes somewhat estranged from her, she has to kind of refine her life and herself. And
now, what made you decide to jump genres and decide I'm ready for fiction or I want to try fiction?
Well, I've always wanted to try fiction, but I felt like I really wanted to get my memoir out of the way first. And of course, I do have another memoir in me because, as you said, I went on this year-long road trip, and a lot has happened in my life, and a lot has changed, but I feel like I need to be a little farther removed from it, to write a little more objectively about it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, in this particular novel, like I said, it deals with some things that I didn't really cover in my memoir that were still important to me. So, and it's just the search for love that we all have and you know, the obstacles in the way of that. And so it's really a book just about, you know, different types of love and finding love and, you know, avoiding love and
right, wanting it and avoiding it at the same time. That's a common thing.
Yeah.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Well, that's another topic that will never go out of style. The quest for love and the human condition. So it's,
well, if it does, I hope it waits until after my book is published.
This book is done yet. What do you do? This is an interesting question that I get all the time from clients and students. Do you have a certain set schedule for your writing? Do you have certain rituals that you undertake?
Oh, I wish I did. You know, I'll tell you, I wrote Elephant Girl. And one of the reasons I think I wrote it, and I wrote it in 8 months. I wrote the first draft in 8 months.
That's not bad.
Was because I was living in a not so happy situation. And so every day I left. And I drove up to a Starbucks parking lot. And I would sit in that parking lot from about 8 in the morning until I was done writing. And sometimes that was 10, 11 at night, sometimes later.
Mm-hmm.
And Starbucks was open till 10 p.m., and I would go in there 4 or 5 times and get a triple venti non-fat latte. And I would sit in that truck all day, and I did this every single day, 7 days a week.
Now, why were you sitting in your
months.
Truck? Why were you not sitting in the actual Starbucks?
Oh, because I can't write when there are other people around.
Oh, really? Okay. See, because I actually do write while I'm in Starbucks. That's a good, you know, to get started. I write.
No.
I think I wrote my first
draft. I have
draft.
To have, like, silence. And the truck was perfect because it was small and contained. And I would actually go park in the farthest corner of the parking lot. This was in a tiny town called Las Lunas, New Mexico. And, you know, so it was this gigantic empty parking lot around it. And I would go park in the nearest far corner. And I wrote like the Dickens. Well, you know, and I thought, well, I'll come to Tucson and I'll write this book. And I have this really cute little cottage with a really private yard and a dog. And everything's very, very sweet and mellow and lovely. And I have the hardest time writing here.
It's you got to get back in that truck and go back to the... Well, that's what it is. Sometimes people think, oh, the romanticized version of a writer's life is a little isolated cottage by the lake and everything's going to be great. Sometimes adverse conditions will lead you to a more productive...
Sometimes peace is distracting.
Okay. Well, that's why you should write in the Starbucks.
I really cannot write around people at all because talk about distracting. I will notice, I notice everything in my environment, which is why... A small environment with no distractions is best for me.
That's
but
right,
if there's so much as somebody with an untied shoe or somebody having a conversation that sounds interesting, I will tune into everything.
Gotcha. Yeah. Well, I sometimes do that too, but then I kind of incorporate it. I don't know, just to get my juices flowing because as a writer, you spend a lot of time by yourself, so I kind of like to get out there and sort of get other... influences, but I know what you mean. Once you really get down to it, you have to have that solitary time. Unfortunately, that's
One day I would like, you know, to have like my own little office space. Like I went to a writer's retreat once in Minnesota that was just great. They had these little 8x8 writing sheds, and they were perfect. They were just these little tiny spaces out in the middle of nowhere, very private, and you know, you could spend, they had a little plug-in for your computer and your coffee and whatever. And one day I would like to have that because I find like being in my house too distracting. There's too much to do and, oh, God, I want to wash the dishes and I should be doing the laundry. the dog needs to be brushed. So I would just love to one day have that, just, you know, a little tiny shed.
Well, there's a goal for you. But do you find if you put a schedule for yourself, like if you say, hey, I'm going to work definitely between the hours of 10 and 3 or even 10 and noon?
Oh, Amy Beth, you give me much too much credit. I have virtually no discipline, and my sleep schedule is so off. I sometimes I sleep late, sometimes I sleep early. I wish I had that kind of discipline, and I think I will as I come closer, I'm editing this book right now, and I think as I come closer to doing the second go around, I will be a little more disciplined. But no, discipline isn't really in my nature at all. I really have to force it on myself.
Well, you obviously have, though, because you managed to finish one book and you're already in the finished draft stage of another one. So clearly you've done it somehow, with or without discipline. There's some discipline
in
there somewhere.
Yeah, it's all kind of been hodgepodge. It's like, you know, oh, do I feel like writing now? Okay, great, it's 3 a.m., I'll do it now. You know, and sometimes I'll do it at 7 a.m., and, you know, sometimes
so
I won't do it
kinda,
for 3 days.
You do kind of go with the muse. You don't have the Dorothy Parker theory that the trick for writing is to put the ass in the seat. That's what she used to say, right? You just have to do it. You have to buckle down and just do it.
Well, that is how you do it, and that's a great point. It's why I guess I will probably never be prolific. I may have 3 or 4 books left in me, but I'll never be, you know, one of those people that churns out a book every year.
We all can't be Joyce Carol Oates, is what you're trying to say.
Right, exactly.
Don't get how she does what she does, that's for sure. But what you do is important, Jane, and you do it at your own pace. There's nothing wrong with that. And I hope people will check out your website, janedevin.com. I'm so happy we finally got the connection working, because it was a pleasure to talk with you. I hope you come back and keep us posted on the new project when it comes closer to fruition. Will you do that?
I will, and thank you so much, Amy Beth.
It's a pleasure to have you. Jane Devin, the website is janedevin.com. You can also find your various musings on politics and the world on the Huffington Post. I know you have a lot of interesting things to say about all kinds of subjects, so come back and share those too. How about it, okay?
All right. Thanks for having
Jane.
Me.
Appreciate it. Take care.
All right. Bye-bye.
That's Jane Devin here on the Amy Beth Arkowitz Show, and I'd love you to join us, too. We don't have time for callers. We're running out of time now, but if you have a story to tell, by all means, please hop over to the website. It's amybetharkowitz.com. Click on the contact icon. Tell me about your story. If you're a filmmaker, an author, a musician, theater impresario, social crusader, whoever, we'd love to have you join our little cadre of growing listeners and guests. We're so pleased that more and more people are catching on to our show here at Blog Talk Radio, thanks to the cadre of Hardier regulars who came along with me, and new folks who find us apparently every week. So we're very happy, and I want to thank the party staff at TCS Productions. We're keeping it moving. Not bad today at all, gals. Thanks so much. ML at headquarters, Trudy and Aurora in the booth. It was a good day. We're doing okay. So thanks for joining us. Hey, whatever you do, wherever you go this week, please drive safe, play nice, and dream big. We'll talk next time. Hey, next week, 1 o'clock on Friday, we'll talk with Jessica Handler. She's the author of Invisible Sisters and the forthcoming book Braving the Fire, Writing Through Grief. So we'll talk with her, too. Have yourself a great week. Please take it easy. We'll leave you with little Etta James. It's a good way to launch into the weekend. Late, great Etta James, and respect yourself. Take care.
How in the world do you expect anybody to respect you? Don't give a damn about the man with a Bible in his hand.
He won't stop the air pollution. Now listen, put your hand over your mouth when you cough. That'll help the solution. Don't give a damn about the man with the Bible in his hand. Just get out of here and let the gentleman do his thing. Back yourself. Get down.